This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions every week and online at www.bgov.com, plus right here on the air on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You know, as March Madness rolls into week number two, I can tell right away that your thoughts are immediately turning from basketball to lobbying, right? All right, I can see it. A logical progression. All right, maybe not. But how about if we examine the money that colleges and universities spend lobbying the government? Where does it come from? Bloomberg Government's Dr. Peter Brusso will be here to break it all down for us. The Fort Meade-Odenton area is in desperate need of a makeover. Those of you who live out there along the 175 corridor know exactly what I'm talking about. Almost looks like a bomb went off over there and no one ever really cleaned up. Neela's laughing here because she knows it's right. Well, after 45 years, the area is finally getting a facelift, just in time for another 15,000 jobs to relocate to the area as a result of the base realignment and closure. Peter Crispino is an author from the Arundel Voice newspaper, a reporter. He'll be here in a little while to explain exactly why it took so long and what's happening to an area that desperately needs a makeover. But we're going to kick off the program with a brand new analysis about mortgage rules taking a backseat to Freddie and Fannie. BGov's Dr. Neela Richardson's here with her piece entitled Qualified Mortgages and GSEs, Fannie and Freddie Set Underwriting Standards, Blunting the Impact of New Mortgage Obligation Rules. Dr. Richardson, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Anytime. We heard you chuckle, and we love that chuckle. Before we dive into this, I want to kind of take a step back. Let's hop in our little BGov time machine. Back to January, when the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau kind of wrapped up the ability to pay and qualified mortgage rule. What is it?
Well, to really explain what it is, we have to actually even go further back.
No problem.
So can we hop back in that time machine about five more years?
No problem.
Because 5 years ago, at the height of the housing boom, a lot of mortgages were being originated that weren't of good quality. These were mortgages that were underwritten with basically no documentation about income or assets. They were mortgages that were only requiring interest-only payments, no payments on principal. There were mortgages that were called negative amortization mortgages, where every payment you were adding to the size of your principal payment instead of subtracting. And so all of these mortgages in some way or another affected the majority of people who took these mortgages out. And some of them actually led to delinquency and foreclosure, which triggered the housing crisis that we saw. What the qualified mortgage rule does is to set underwriting standards, a benchmark of what is a quality mortgage and what characteristics a mortgage would have to absolve lenders of the responsibility of being sued by a consumer. So as long as these lenders did due diligence on income and assets and originated mortgages that didn't have these awful features that could blow up on consumers, then those mortgages would be considered quality mortgages under the federal law.
I'm beginning to sense this may not necessarily be a good thing. I can see where it's good in a business sense, but if I'm a consumer who was taking advantage of that interest-only loan or that negative amortization loan, what are my alternatives now? Subprime, is that where I'm going to end up?
Well,
paying a higher interest rate?
You know, these products had existed for a very long time, but they were niche products. Mm-hmm. You know, they were particular products for particular consumers. But what happened during the housing boom is that they were mass marketed to everybody, and not everybody could handle the terms. And so the qualified mortgage, and I'm going to start calling it the QM rule now, you know, what it does is it says, okay, no more of these exotic features in mortgages. And it says that the consumer would have to have a debt-to-income ratio, all of their debts versus all of their incomes, of 43%. And so it really helps that consumer, you know, helps that lender determine the consumer's ability to pay much more accurately than what was done during the housing boom. Now, to your point, there's nothing in the current law that says that these mortgages can't be originated by lenders. They're just not going to meet the qualified mortgage standard. So if you originate an interest-only loan as a lender or an option arm loan as a lender, you would have to take the full responsibility should that loan go delinquent, that a consumer would come back and sue you for not meeting the ability to pay standard. And that's absolutely a risk that the lender could take on if there was a market for these kinds of mortgages.
You know what? There is another silver lining in here. Lenders can't require borrowers to pay more than 3% of the total amount in points and fees. Sometimes people walk away paying double digits in fees
absolutely.
And points and such. So I can actually see where this may be beneficial in some cases and may have a negligible impact as well. Freddie and Fannie purchase a lot of these loans.
Well, Freddie and Fannie purchase a lot of loans altogether.
Well, of course. They purchase a lot of loans altogether. Now, they, under this rule, will have an opportunity to say, you know what, it's yours. You didn't do your due diligence. Buy it back.
Right. So the rule takes effect in January of 2014.
Okay.
Freddie and Fannie had bought a lot of loans during the housing boom that, you know, failed to meet a good quality underwriting standard, and they paid for that, severe losses to their single family book. What the companies have done subsequently is force lenders to repurchase loans that were not adequately underwritten,
mm-hmm.
and they've been very aggressive about that. Now, it's not just for the companies. Now that these are government-sponsored, in conservatorship companies, they're trying to get money back for the taxpayer as well. So they're going after a variety of well-known lenders like Bank of America, like Wells Fargo, all of the major originators and the smaller mortgage lenders, and saying, hey, look, you sold us some bad loans that went delinquent, you know, a couple years, maybe even after you sold it to us.
Yeah.
We want you to repurchase that back from us.
Yeah.
Now, the effect of that is to freeze a certain quality of loan from being originated in the market, because there's a fear that Fannie and Freddie will make you repurchase that mortgage back.
It's going to force the lenders to now be a lot more diligent about the paperwork
Absolutely.
Up front, collecting everything.
Absolutely.
So they may be examining you, the lender, with a fine-tooth comb, or the borrower with a fine-tooth comb.
And we've seen that. We've seen that it's much harder to get a loan. You know, I've purchased three homes in my lifetime. This last purchase, I had to show tax returns for the first time.
Wow.
I had to do so much more in terms of documentation of income and assets that I never had to do before for a conventional mortgage. And so those underwriting requirements have increased dramatically as the FICO score and the down payment that a borrower needs to get a conventional loan. We've seen tightening of credit at a scale that we haven't experienced in the recent, you know, 5 to 10 year history.
Freddie and Fannie are in that conservatorship right now. And as long as they're in that conservatorship, they have this ability to force people to buy back?
They have always had the ability to force lenders to repurchase loans that did not meet their underwriting criteria.
Now they have the strong arm of the government behind them.
But now they have the government behind them, and the law exempts Freddie and Fannie from following the qualified mortgage statute. So that means any mortgage that they purchase meets the qualified mortgage for 7 years or until conservatorship ends. Now, we haven't seen a real attempt by Congress to end this conservatorship. And it's very hard to determine how long. In fact, we did a study at BGov saying that we don't expect really significant GSE reform in the next 4 years.
Wow.
Right.
So therein lies the rub.
Right.
That's the crux of this entire thing. Qualified mortgages. By the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest right now is Dr. Neela Richardson, who's done an analysis entitled Qualified Mortgages and GSEs, Fannie and Freddie Set Underwriting Standards, Blunting the Impact of New Mortgage Origination Rules. And you just hit the nail right on the head. Anything is a qualified mortgage in their eyes.
Well, as long as it meets the Fannie and Freddie underwriting criteria, and they have tightened their own criteria for purchasing loans. We show that in the study that 99% of the mortgages now barred by the QM rule, once it takes effect in 2014,
mm-hmm.
That they have dropped their purchases of these mortgages by 99%. So the GSEs themselves are not buying loans with exotic features. They've also significantly decreased their purchases of loans that we call subprime, those with FICO scores of 600 and 60 or less. And so these features have kind of drifted away from Fannie and Freddie purchases. And when Fannie and Freddie are nearly, you know, virtually all of the conventional conformity right. market, they really do have the ability to set the origination terms. And that's what we've seen.
Mortgage Banking Association probably can't be too happy about this. Have they done anything to quell this turnaround, so to speak?
Well, the Mortgage Bankers Association's major concern with the qualified mortgage rule was that it was going to be too tight, that it was going to require significant down payments or lower DTIs and other criteria that would make it even harder for lenders to lend in the current economic environment. They had been fairly supportive of the finalized QM rule, and I think they see that the GSEs as the only buyer as just a reality.
Right.
We haven't seen private capital return to the market, and until GSEs are reformed, we won't see that.
What's next? What do we have to look forward to next?
Well, the next rule that the industry is paying attention to deals with the securitization of these mortgage loans. So the first rule talks about lenders originating them to buyers. The second rule will put standards on those same lenders packaging these loans up and selling them off to investors. We're going to see that Freddie and Fannie will have the same influence in this market as they do in the lending market, because they're setting the terms as the majority seller and securitizer of this market. And so they really do have a dominant effect. And these new mortgage rules, though great, though they will have a long-term effect on the industry, in the short run, they're going to be blunted, as the study says, by the dominance of Freddie and Fannie.
It will be interesting to watch this develop over the course of the next few years. I mean, I don't understand why private capital can't jump in. I mean, let me pull out my wallet here. Let me see what I can do. I'm gonna turn this around, Neela.
Alan will be a one-man, nonstop force in changing the structure of the housing market.
I got credit cards. Can make it happen.
Fantastic.
Dr. Neela Richardson is her name. Check out the study on bgov.com, Qualified Mortgages and GSEs. Definitely worth a read, especially if you're a homeowner or thinking about buying a home. You better get your paperwork ready.
That's absolutely correct.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For those of you with children, you'll be able to relate to this story. So my son is 5 years old, and he's of the age where he now wants me to come sleep in his room with him. And so I lay down on the floor next to him, hoping that he'll fall asleep, and I'll be able to get up and just meander on back to my bedroom. And he'll never be the wiser, right? So I'm laying on the floor in his bedroom a couple of weeks ago, and I'm reading a copy of The Arundel Voice. And I come across this story that has me so intrigued, I never left my son's room. He fell asleep, I stayed there, went to sleep, and said, how can I get the author of this article on the air? Well, he's here right now. His name is Peter Crispino. Great, Peter, how are you?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, the article that had me so intrigued had to do with redevelopment of the Odenton area right around Fort Meade, NSA, as a result of the base realignment and closure. Now, the thing that got me the most about this is I've lived in that area for a long time, and I've heard whispers of things going on and such. Never, ever have I ever seen anybody break ground. But in the past few years, it's like a resurgence in the area. Peter, you can tell me more about this, and the article was wonderful, by the way. Tell us what's going on in the Odenton area as a result of this realignment.
Well, it really has been remarkable. Since BRAC came about several years ago, you've had finally breaking ground on this project that's 45 years in the making. It's over 1,600 acres total. But in terms of what has already started, you have a number of retail locations, a number of high-end luxury apartments that are already open. Several opened last spring. One is called The Haven at Odenton Gateway. That's already 80% at capacity. And another one that opened just last June, which is already at about 65% capacity. So it's really remarkable. These jobs that have been brought in have really caused just a huge spike in the construction, in retail, in office, development and in obviously residential homes as well.
That's exactly what hooked me into the story. The fact that we're talking about sequestration, we're talking about people being laid off, the economy is such a place where it is today. Yet in Odenton, around the military bases, NSA, obviously more divisions are moving in over there. We go from whispers years ago of Fort Meade potentially closing to expanding to the likes of none other, one of the largest bases now in the country as a result. And a lot of people who listen to this program may very well be moving into some of the areas that we're talking about right now. And they're gorgeous. I mean, the apartments and the condos that are going up over there are like none I've ever seen before. So kind of exciting. And the fact that it took 45 years to actually make this happen. Why so long? What was the holdup?
Well, it was always sort of something new. It became sort of a pipe dream over the years, and it just never had the funding. It never had the right people behind the project. And, you know, somewhat ironically, as the nation entered this recession, you suddenly had this, you know, the base realignment, which caused them to finally get this project off the ground at one of the worst economic times of the last 45 years. So it really is remarkable the way it has taken off when it took off, and based on just how incredibly long it did take. It was 1968 was when the plan was first put into place, and 5 years later, an entire town center was imagined by a commission, and yeah, it really started to come around in about the late 90s, 1999, and then things finally got off the ground, and ground was broken in about 2006.
Amazing. You're talking about 3 million square feet of office space, 1,500 high-end apartments, 300 townhomes, and nearly 1 million square feet of retail space. An amazing undertaking at a time in which the dollar is being stretched thin. And I applaud everyone for coming together and making this happen. After 45 years, I can say there's new construction in Odenton.
Finally, right?
Exactly. Peter, tell us about the Arundel Voice.
Well, we started last May. We are a hyper-local, community-based organization. We cover exclusively the positive news. We want to be a newspaper that every home in the area can pick up, anyone in the household can pick up and read, and you're not going to worry about reading about murders or things like that. We cover hyper local news, and it's been very successful. So far, 9 months into the program, the Arundel Voice has really taken off.
His name is Peter Crispino. He's with the Arundel Voice newspaper. Check them out at the website, which is brand new. What's the address?
www.arundelvoice.com.
The story is amazing, and you'll be able to find it out there about the resurgence of Odenton. And for those of you listening who may very well be getting reassigned to that area, word has it about 15,000 more might be making their way over the next 10 years. Check out the Arundel Voice and I stopped by the train station. The Heritage Society in Odenton has a wonderful little display of what the town looked like years ago. I'm astonished by it every time I hop on the mark. So, and hopefully you will too. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Alan. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And March Madness is now in full swing. But regardless if you're rooting for the Harvard Crimson or the Great Danes of Albany or maybe even the Hoyas of Georgetown, everyone wants one single thing, and that would be the glory of the basketball honor known as the National Championship. But not as obvious, many schools are also pushing for legislative priorities on the national level through lobbying right here in the district. To tell us the tale of the tape is Dr. Peter Bruce from Bloomberg Government. Hey, Peter, how are you?
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I never really thought about schools or colleges lobbying Congress on behalf of their issues, but it's obviously a big thing.
Sure. One of the great things we do at Bloomberg Government is connecting all these different legislative issues. And universities are more complicated institutions than they were even 10 years ago. Because now they operate not only as research institutions, but they have to worry about student health issues, employment issues, and even federal research funding. So all these issues create a huge need for schools to press their legislative agenda here in Washington, D.C.
Why don't you walk us through what you found?
Sure. A lot of schools are spending a lot of money on lobbying. Duke University, it's seated number 2 in the Midwestern bracket, spends on average just under $500,000 on lobbying. And their issues, they range from everything from energy research to Medicare and Medicaid provider payments, because they have a great medical center down in North Carolina, to even research oversight ethics. Every time the National Institute for Health or the National Science Foundation promulgates a new regulation, that's additional work for the university and additional enforcement stuff that they have to do that takes money away from their research side. Their opponent is my beloved alma mater, the University at Albany, and they didn't report any direct lobbying themselves on the federal level, a lot on the state level lobbying the state government, but their system-wide did report about $100,000 lobbying, mainly related to budget sequester and how that's going to impact the research funding they have for nanotechnology and science and research.
So let's talk a little bit about Georgetown. What kind of money are they talking about?
Spending about between $40,000 and $80,000, depending on the year. And one of the things that they pushed for is this Daniel Webster Congressional Clerkship Act of 2011 was one of their big issues. And, you know, of course, know Daniel Webster as being this prominent debater in the U.S. Senate back in the 1800s. And so actually digging into it, it's this neat program that would provide or force Congress to take on clerks who are recent law school graduates. Of course, we know Georgetown Law School has the best law school program in the District of Columbia. And so the idea here is their students could then go work for Congress and gain that life-changing experience of working on the issues of the people and gaining some foothold, as well as helping to employment for law school students, which is a serious issue. One of the big issues for all universities is making sure that the money keeps flowing.
Right.
Because as much as it is a educational institution, they're also 501c3 nonprofits. And when there were issues about fixing the budget, one of the things they were talking about taking away was charitable contributions. So we think about business implications of government action, that central to what BGov does. If we lost that kind of charitable contribution, a lot of these universities would be hurting.
All right, so these schools are spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases on lobbying. Where's this money coming from? Are the students, is this coming off the sweats of the students' parents' backs that they're spending this money?
No, most times they get the money from alumni donations to pay directly for the operations of their lobbying effort. It's also, most universities employ a director of external relations, and that person probably handles doing some alumni contact, handling some neighborhood issues. My other alma mater, American University, has a specific person whose job it is to ensure that we have smooth neighborhood relations with the people in Upper Northwest.
Understood.
The way that the law works is if you spend more than 20% of your time doing any kind of legislative contact with the federal government, you do have to report that income and the money you're spending on that, including that person's salary.
Let's talk about the University of Kansas, ranked number 1 in the Southern bracket. What kind of money are they spending from donations now, not tuition money? What kind of money are they spending?
So in 2009, they spent just about $500,000. In 2012, they went down just under $250,000. And one of the interesting things, their huge issue is vortex energy generation and how that can help to simplify our energy budget and help to improve the actual energy economy, and really tying into this green energy research and this push by President Obama. So it's their way of being able to align their research goals with the goals of the President of the United States. They also are very concerned about student financial aid and sequestration.
Oh,
sequestration, yeah. When you start cutting the federal budget, you know, you have serious issues with the National Science Foundation, also with the Department of Defense. You know, we often think about R&D for Department of Defense going to private military contractors. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money being spent in the applied sciences as well as in some of the social sciences, particularly, you know, even with language banks. We start thinking about what language needs that our military needs. So if you can provide some money for students to learn, you know, Farsi, Korean, Chinese, Russian, these are all very important issues.
501c3 organizations, tax deductible, number 1, if you make a donation to them. Number 2, they need to file their tax reports for people to examine.
Correct, the 990s.
The 990s. They've got to file them on. There's a website that you can go to take a look at what percentage of that charitable contribution is being used towards operating costs and actually doing good in the community.
And actually here in D.C., if you go down K Street, there's called the Foundation Center, and they have all of these charitable resources you can look up. It's also, if you're giving money to a charity, you should feel free to ask them to see their 990
yeah.
and to share their information with
them. That's our little public service to you. make sure that you're giving your money to someone who's actually using it for good and not padding someone else's pocket.
One of the things that I really like is, you know, when I make my charitable contributions, is being able to see the direct impact of how they're spending money. But I'm always very glad to give checks to American University and to the University at Albany.
Well, there you go. And wearing the colors today.
I am wearing my special lucky hat and hoping for the best season for my Great Danes.
Dr. Peter Brusso looks like a cat in the hat at this point.
Purple and gold, baby.
Purple and gold cat and hat sitting next to me. It's Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Alan.
For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.